This is the act of repression. And it's the internalization of violence. And then when you internalize and you repress something, it comes out in the worst possible way. So for the first 3 centuries, Christianity was very, very nonviolent, the most nonviolent religion, and then it became the most violent. Today, we want to focus on a concept that is widely discussed in the world, and that is the concept of religious violence. That has become, in recent decades, a buzzword that is used by many, many people. It seems to suggest that there is a kind of violence that is different from regular violence, and that is religious violence. That is violence that's motivated by religious drives, or it's justified by religious reasons. And the interesting thing about this topic is that you have two groups of people that seem to be the very opposite, on totally two sides of the table. But there's one thing that they have in common. So one group is atheists, that they don't like any religion. They think all religions are bad. And then there's this almost cliche by now that many secular people are saying, atheist people, they're saying that religions, generally, doesn't matter which, religions are the source of much violence, or of most violence, or the worst violence in the world. And there was even one of them that went as far as saying that religion is the root of all evil. and they don't care if it's Islam or Christianity or Judaism, it doesn't matter, because religions are irrational and religions are then used to serve some absolute truth. And then once you believe in a truth that's absolute, then you believe that it's above all morality, and then you can wage a holy war based on your religion. And so these people, they don't care which religion it is. They think all religions are bad, and then therefore that religions are the source of terrible violence, of religious violence. Now, on the other hand, you have a bunch of people who come out in the defense of religion. And they say, they say a few things. One thing they say is that, come on, religions haven't been the most violent ideologies in the world. In fact, the two most violent, most lethal ideologies in the history of humanity have been the most anti-religious ideologies. One was communism, the other was Nazism. Communism was deeply, deeply secular, and it was all about relinquishing religions. And Nazism maybe had a pagan element to it, which you can call religious, but anyway, it was against biblical monotheism. It was against the idea of Judaism and Christianity, and it wanted to get rid of this. And it turns out that if you abandon religion, and you abandon especially the idea of mankind as being created in the image of God, you have much more bloodshed. But one interesting thing is that these people who come to the defense of religion is that they say, no, don't say this about religions. All religions are very, very good. All religions are powers of good. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they all want to make the world a better place, and they all want to make everyone a believer, and they want to build healthy communities with charity, with kindness. And yes, all of them have some hard texts. They have some texts in their sources that are maybe a source of embarrassment. And those texts, those hard texts, they could be abused by violent people. So that you can have some violent Muslims, some violent Christians, some violent Jews, and they misread or take out of context those hard texts, and then violence ensues. But it's not that their religions are violent. They're all really, really good. And two people who've said this over the past few years. One of them is a British historian of religion called Karen Armstrong. She had a book called Fields of Blood. It was called Religion and the History of Violence, because her point is that history of violence has nothing to do with religion. There's a history of violence. Human people are violent, and religions are all good, but some violent people used religion as an excuse to do violence. And another example closer to our Jewish home is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He wrote a book called Not in God's Name, confronting religious violence. But if you read the book, you see that he doesn't go too much into the differences between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. He only says what I said before, that they're all good, but they can be a source of violence if put in the wrong hands. Now, what both of the sides of this argument don't do so much is trying to compare the different religions and to see if all of the religions are as liable to produce acts of violence as the other ones. If they're all equally violent or equally non-violent, but then it can be abused. And what they're doing is very wrong, because there are very, very basic differences between Christianity, Islam, and Judaism in the way they view power, control, politics. And this is something very important to keep in mind. So what I did was, and I just recently finished this, is that I wrote a long essay and I called it The Varieties of Religious Violence. And this is a play off a very famous book by William James called The Varieties of Religious Experience. It's a classic book written in 1902. And William James was a Protestant, and he was an academic, and he lost his faith, but then he regained it in a very interesting story. And then he wrote this book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which is basically started off the whole field in academia called the psychology of religion. And so, playing off of his title, I call this essay The Varieties of Religious Violence, because I wanted to point out the different takes on, again, power and how you exercise power and the limits of power in the three religions. So I'm going to basically present the basic case to you. I'm going to do it in a different way than I did in the essay. I'm going to go over in the historical order of the religions. I'm going to start with Judaism. In the essay, I put Judaism in the end, because that's like the final sort of, it puts everything together. But here I'm going to put it at the beginning, and that's the historical order. And the main thing to understand about Judaism, right, and then we're going to move to Christianity and then to Islam. So the main thing to understand about Judaism in the context of violence, warfare, use of political power, etc., is that it all hinges on the tension between the written Torah and the oral Torah. If people who haven't been raised on the Bible, on the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, read it, open it for the first time at a later age in life, and in this day and age, that we live in a very liberal, democratic societies, and societies in which basically most violence or most violent acts, most brutal acts, we don't confront them face to face. We see a lot of brutality on the movies, but that's not real, and we know it's fake. We don't have public hangings. We don't have public executions. We don't have flogging or any kind of physical punishment. People don't die at home anymore. They die at hospitals. And there are some capital punishments, including in the U.S., but it's all done in a way nobody sees it. So the world has become very sterile. We don't see much real violence. We see a lot of fake, phony movie violence. We don't see any real violence. And then we read the Bible, and the Bible is describing a very violent world. And the Bible seems also to be describing some acts of very powerful violence that seem to be, that are enacted by God himself. God creates the world, creates humanity, and after 10 generations, he decides to wipe all of humanity, everyone, with a flood, with only one family of 8 surviving. Later on, he destroys 2 full cities. There was last week, Sodom and Gomorrah. Not really last week in the Torah. And then you go on to the 10 plagues of Egypt, including the plague of the firstborn. And there's also some very difficult to read injunctions, commandments, to wipe out the Amalekites completely, and also to wipe out the 7 nations that inhabit the land of Canaan. When the people of Israel approach the land of Canaan, then they need to wipe out the 7 nations that are on it. It's very hard to read sometimes. And there's a lot of capital punishments. Many, many capital punishments. Many, many commandments in the Torah. It is said if you don't do them, if you transgress them, then your punishment is capital punishment. And some of these have to do with things that are, in our day and age, not considered immoral one bit. They're all commandments between us and Hashem. For example, not observing the Sabbath. If you don't observe the Sabbath according to the Torah, the written Torah, then you need to be killed, a capital punishment. So all this is very off-putting, to say the least, for many, many people. They read this in the Bible, and they see these terrible things. And they say, how can we believe in such a God? And for many people, including those atheists, they simply quote one verse, a couple of verses from the Bible, and say, what on earth are we still doing venerating a book like this? Why do we need to believe a book that says all these horrible things? And let's throw this book away. But the thing that people don't understand is that Judaism is not based on the written Torah alone. We're not Karaites. Karaites are those who only have the written Torah. And we used to have groups like that in our history. They were called the Sadducees and the Baitosim. They had all kinds of groups that did not accept the oral Torah. And if we were, had we been only living our lives according to the written Torah, then we would have been living in a very, very different world. And Judaism would have capital punishments all over the place. And would have the energy, the total, everything would have been totally different. But it's not what's happening. What's happening, and that's the way it was supposed to happen. It's not a historical contingency. It was there from the very beginning. But it took a while for it to be fully manifest itself. Because one of the differences between the written Torah and the oral Torah is that the written Torah was given during a short span of time. The books of Moses were given throughout the 40 years in the desert, and then there were a few more centuries before the full Tanakh was canonized. But that's it. And then you have millennia and millennia going on after that. But the oral Torah is slower to emerge, and it sort of grows from the bottom up, not so much from the top down. And the oral Torah, what it does is that it softens and weakens and makes the written Torah bearable. And it takes almost all the very, very violent, harsh, powerful statements and verses and commandments, and it puts them in such a context that you end up in a world that's very, very not violent. In a world that's very kind, that's very generous, very soft, very lenient, very forgiving. So you can imagine that in the written Torah, Hashem is, so to speak, throwing down very, you know, rocks, fiery rocks, like on Sodom and Gomorrah. He has all these stories, all these injunctions, all these commandments, and all these descriptions later on, just all the wars that are described, very difficult to read in according to our, again, standards. So all these sort of rocks are being dropped on us from on high, but what the sages did was that they tied parachutes to these rocks. And then the rocks landed softly on the ground. They cooled down, they landed on the ground. And I'll give you just a few examples. So we read that Joshua was supposed to come into the land of Canaan and kill seven nations. That sounds horrible. As if he came in and started massacring everyone. But the sages tell us, no, no, no. And they learned this from subtle elements in the verses. And they say, of course not. He gave them, each town was, they received letters and notes in advance, and they were told, we're going to attack you, so no element of surprise. We're going to attack you, and now you have three options. You can leave, you can evacuate. If you evacuate, nothing will happen to you, and you can leave, and we're not into killing people. You can evacuate, or you can surrender, because we were given this land by God. There is an absolute truth that's God-given, but it's not so cruel. You can surrender to us, and then you can live under us. And that's also an option. But if you don't choose to evacuate and you don't choose to surrender, then you'll be viewed as a warrior. Now, learning this from the sages puts the whole thing in a totally, totally different context. That's one example. Another example is capital punishment. So the Torah seems to be, the written Torah, seems to be very liberal with capital punishment. However, the sages added so many contingencies and conditions and criteria that need to be met, that we end up with the Jewish law in which it's virtually impossible to find someone guilty of a capital crime. It's virtually impossible. If you learn the rules and the way they're written and all the conditions placed by the sages, they were so afraid of exercising capital punishment that they made it virtually impossible. And indeed, it was said that a Sanhedrin, a Jewish court, that would put someone to death once every 70 years was considered extreme. So that means that most Sanhedrin, most courts would do it even less often. Right? In the US, just for comparison's sake, last time I checked, in the USA, there are 70 capital punishments executions a year. But it says here that if the court of Jewish courts would execute someone once every 17 years, it was considered like lethal, extra crazy lethal. So, and there's more and more examples. An eye for an eye for the sages, this means paying the price of, if an eye was taken out, then the person who took out your eye needs to pay you compensation. You need to find a way to measure to how much money an eye costs, or an arm or a leg, whatever it is. And it's obviously there's no an eye, literal an eye for an eye. It's not even an option according to the sages. This is the literal reading of the verse. An eye for an eye means monetary compensation. And there are many, many more examples. So what you end up with is something very interesting. Okay, I have a siren going off. And that means that a rocket is on its way to Tel Aviv. Don't worry. It takes a minute and a half. I'm going to go to the shelter. I'll be back in 2.5 minutes. Okay, you can pray for me, but really it's all taken out by Iron Dome, almost all of them. But I have to go now. So hang on. Say you can say some psalms. I'll be back in about 2 minutes.
A few moments later.
I'm back. I'm safe. Quite a lot of booms this time. Yeah, where was I? What we end up with is a very, very interesting tension between the two Torahs, the written Torah, the oral Torah. The written Torah puts it on the table that there is an absolute divine transcendent truth that's not a human convention. It's not just a, like an offer that you may or may not do. It's not something that's, you know, just a custom or a tradition or something, you know, so polite and nice and liberal. There's an absolute truth. It's very, very weighty. It's very total. And in many ways, if we don't observe this truth, then our lives are, they become in a sense meaningless. That's why there's so much capital punishment there. On the other hand, this transcendent truth is mediated by the oral Torah in such a way that it gives us a lot of room in which to consider it and choose to accept it or choose not to accept it. We are given a lot of space, a lot of room that's very forgiving, that gives a lot of place for mercy and kindness, and that doesn't want to have this sort of laying heavily over our heads, over our shoulders, in a way that we lose our sense of free will, and we lose our sense of, we're constantly working out of fear. Judaism doesn't want the Torah, doesn't want us to operate out of this constant fear of this absolute truth that's weighing down on us. So the oral Torah makes it so that we can live in a society in which people don't observe the Sabbath, but we don't kill them, and we don't kill other transgressors, and creates a very tolerant world. And this reflects an element of God also. God is also tolerant. God is not just this absolute monarch that demands everyone obey him. He's also a very, very tolerant monarch that's tolerant of his creator, of the world, and has been tolerant over many, many millennia of human culture. So this tension is very, very beautiful. And this is why Judaism over the years has been, relatively speaking, not a very violent religion. However, it does have all these texts that are sometimes very, very harsh. This tension is a deep one. It means that we have both sides of the story. We have this transcendent side and the immanent side. We have the side of absolute truth and the side in which we make room for a very tolerant society. Now, all this gives you a good background for what happened when Christianity came into the world stage and when what happened when Islam came into the world stage. Christianity was born towards the end of the Second Temple period. The Second Temple was still standing, but the Jewish people were deeply, deeply powerless. We didn't rule, or we didn't govern ourselves. We were governed by the Roman Empire. During Jesus' lifetime, the Sanhedrin lost its ability that it hardly used anyway to execute capital punishment. Shortly after he died, the temple itself was destroyed, and so we didn't even have sacrifices. It was like one of the weakest, lowest, most point in the history of Jewish politics, in which the sages basically receded from the political realm to the private realm and were constructing this very, very, again, lenient, kind society that is focused as an intellectual pursuit on prayer. Christianity was born of the spirit of the oral Torah. The written Torah was a book that was in the background and you would study it, but it didn't tell you how to live right now. Because again, we were outside of the realm of politics, outside of the realm of being powerful. We were powerless. What Christianity did, starting with Jesus, going on with Paul, going on with the other generations, was that they took this state of powerlessness and they, in a sense, they sanctified it. They took the state of exile that we were in. We were maybe in the land of Israel, but we were in a state of exile because we were governed by the Romans. And they idealized it. They sanctified it. They said, and this Christianity came into the world, the theology, the original theology of Christianity is totally apolitical and pacifistic in a radical way. So this is why Jesus says, love your enemy. Turn the other cheek to your enemy. This is a radicalization of basic traits that also Judaism have, that you don't need to be vengeful or resentful of the other person. But you don't have to turn the other cheek in Judaism. And you don't have to love your enemy because you're not obligated to. Maybe he's a very, very wicked person. You should love the essence of who he is, but you shouldn't love the acts of what he's doing and be tolerant of those acts. But the way Jesus taught his lessons was that you not only do you need to love the essence and the soul, and so Christians say, love the sinner, hate the sin. So you may hate the sin, but you're, according to the way Jesus taught us, you need to be totally tolerant of the sins. And turning the other cheek is almost like encouraging those sins to continue. It's a total negation of the self. Judaism was in a state of being apolitical by force. Jesus turned it into the ideal. He said, give unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar and give unto God what belongs to God. Total separation of church and state, of religion and politics. Total separation. And he created a community of people that were outside of regular society, no aspirations to govern society, living without any properties. Basically, it's like a hippie commune. It was like a hippie commune or a kibbutz in which you don't have any property and everything, and you're only focused on prayer and good deeds. He took this to the extreme state in which we don't want to exercise any kind of violence. And you know how extreme it was? Jesus was even anti-self-defense. He didn't have a self-defense clause. At some point, his life is threatened. One of his students takes out the sword in order to protect his teacher, Jesus. And Jesus says, put back your sword, for he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. And basically says, even self-defense is not in my book. This is why he's crucified. And the crucifix, the symbol of this anti-hero in the sense, or the anti in the sense of it's the opposite of the Greek, Roman, European macho hero. It's the anti antithesis of this hero. It's a very emasculated, passive protagonist that's crucified to a cross and totally powerless. And why? Because he loves everyone, and because he loves everyone so much that he's willing to be to sacrifice himself. This is self-negation of the most radical kind. Now, what happened was that in the first 3 centuries of Christianity, Christianity was loyal to the New Testament. It was a very private, very pacifistic religion that was persecuted, and it didn't exercise any power. And in fact, the only thing that it had was that it deified the people who were killed. So they said that these are the martyrs that were killed for their faith. They were idealized as someone who didn't raise any swords, didn't do any attempt of protecting themselves or fighting, and they allowed themselves to be killed, and they died in testimony for their faith in God. So they idealized this kind of passivity and powerlessness in a radical, radical way. So in a way, Christianity is the least violent religion, right? It's the least violent theology. It's so non-violent that it doesn't even give room for self-defense or for any kind of political warfare, any kind of warfare whatsoever, any kind of violence whatsoever. How did it end up being the religion with the most violent history? Christianity has the most violent history, more than Islam. How come? Because in the 4th century, it became the state religion of the Roman Empire. Amazing, unbelievable turn of events. And then the theology changed, and they introduced the concept of a just war, that if you want to protect holy sites, if you protect the borders of the nation, you need to have a just war. And what happened was that the Roman Empire went on being a very powerful political entity that fights wars and kills people with capital punishment and tortures people. But now it was all done under the flag of Christianity. So Christianity was used to justify regular basic Roman politics and Roman violence. And we end up with the Crusades and the Inquisition. And the Crusades and the Inquisition are responsible for the deaths of millions, Jews and Muslims, during their wars. Now, in a way, you can say what happened was that Christianity repressed the element of violence that's in the godliness and that's in the world and that's in mankind. They tried to ignore it. They tried to say we can live in a world and be totally non-violent. Non-violence allows violence to happen, and it internalizes violence. The martyr that does not protect himself and does not fight and puts on a kind of show that they can live in the world without exercising any kind of power, then A, they allow the wicked, violent person to go on living and doing. And then really what happened is this is so unnatural not to protect yourself and not to fight against evil enemies, is that you internalize this violence that you're repressing, that you're trying to pretend you don't need or that God doesn't need. It was so, again, Christianity was born out of the spirit of the oral Torah, and it pushed the written Torah totally to the background. Interestingly, ironically, it included the written Torah, the Tanakh, in the Christian Bible. The most pages of the Christian Bible are the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh. But it's called the Old Testament. And it serves as a background for the New Testament. And it's there only to basically say that's not what we want. We don't want the Old Testament. We don't want the Old Testament God of wrath or God of fear. We want the New Testament God of love and mercy and kindness. And it's negating, this act of negating, of putting the Tanakh there, in order to negate it, this is the act of repression of an aspect, a real aspect of godliness and divinity. And it's the internalization of violence. And then when you internalize and you repress something, it comes out in the worst possible way. So for the first 3 centuries, Christianity was very, very non-violent, the most nonviolent religion during those times, and then it became the most violent for a long, long time throughout the Middle Ages, and the Inquisition was all the way up to the 19th century. But gradually what happened was that it came back to its roots. So with the Reformation of the 16th century, that's the birth of Protestantism, and then basically Catholicism followed suit in the sense that it was separated from the state, and the West chose to have secular liberal democracies, and Christianity went back to being a very private, personal, powerless, non-political, apolitical, and pacifistic religion. And the West has become very much a culture of peace. So you have all the negative elements of Nazism and fascism, but they are the exceptions to the rule in the sense of where the West, the majority of the West is going. The majority of the West is going in the direction of having a very peaceful liberal democracies, with religion being a private affair. And then it can go back to being what it was supposed to be and the way it was in Christianity. That's why Christians today are very, very peaceful, and they don't want any wars. And they're beautiful examples of people who want to live peacefully. But there, the history of Christianity, and it has to do with its theology, is repressing the violent element, and then it's being burst, and then it comes to the foreground. And by the way, when you're talking about the modern contemporary West going back to its roots, it's a good thing, but there's also a bad element to it, a negative aspect to it, because what is called the post-colonial movement of decolonizing the world from the regime of the West goes along with being very, very apologetic and very pro cultures that are very, very, could be very violent. The fact that Europe opened its gates to millions and millions of refugees or immigrants from Muslim countries is the undoing of Europe. And this is part of the return of the West to the roots of Christianity and you know, turning the other cheek. There was a moment in the previous decade, 2015 or 16, that it was amidst the ISIS terrible terrorist attacks, and you had all these refugees coming from Syria, and many of them not coming from Syria, but pretending they're coming from Syria. And then there was a moment in which Pope Francis came out to a group of immigrants, and he washed their feet. And he washed their feet because this is like a gesture of kindness and humility in his eyes. But what he didn't realize is that the message he's giving them, coming from totally different culture, is that we're weak and you're strong and you can take over. And that's the message they got. And that's why Europe is full of riots wherever there's an Islamic neighborhood. And they brought in millions of people with totally different mindset, totally different set of values. And this white guilt of I'm going to be powerless and I'm going to deify powerlessness, it's that's the negative side of the return to the Christian roots, the original Christian roots of, again, passivity and powerlessness and so on. So this is a deep problem in the West, in a sense, is that the West is very much afraid of power. It sanctifies powerlessness. That could lead, as it led in the Middle Ages, in the history of the Crusades and Inquisition, it led to an excess of violence. And then when they felt guilty over that and they realized it was wrong, they're going back to a kind of powerlessness, which again exposes them to other more violent societies and cultures. And that's a big problem in the West right now. So all this is coming out of the fact that Christianity was born out of the spirit of the oral Torah and Judaism, and repressed or ignored or pushed away the written Torah and that spirit, the spirit of a more of a God that's absolute, that has absolute power, that justifies warfare, that justifies violence, and says basically says that there is room for power, there is room for violence, but you need the balance of the two Torahs. Now, fast forward, if we were talking about the beginning of Christianity, fast forward to the beginning of Islam. Islam comes into the world 6 centuries after Christianity, 3 centuries after it becomes state religion and becomes the big massive religion that it became. But where is it born? This isn't Jews, and it's not in the land of Israel, and it's not coming out of the powerlessness of rabbinic times. Islam is born in the Arabian Peninsula, 7th century, and the Arabian Peninsula during that time was very much a backward society. It was nested between a massive empire called the Persian Empire, another empire, the Byzantine Empire, but it wasn't under any of those empires. It was a very, very primitive society based on clans that were doing commerce, but also fighting each other very often. It was very much like biblical times. There were idol worshippers, and they would take care of each one had a control of an oasis, a source of water, and there would be constant attacks, and you needed to attack back, and you had a lot of capital punishment, a lot of physical punishment, of flogging, and so on. Very violent society, very brutal society that lived, was like a living remnant of biblical times. It didn't have an advanced bureaucracy, an advanced economy. It didn't have agriculture, hardly. So this is the Arabian Peninsula. Muhammad is born into this society. He learns about Christianity and Islam. He falls in love with the monotheistic idea. And then he claims to be a prophet of God, a prophet of Allah, which is God in Arabic. And then he starts teaching people that they shouldn't worship idols and they should sanctify life. That was one of his messages, that you shouldn't just kill anyone that you want. You can't just attack anyone you want. You need to preserve life. And no stealing, and you have to give charity and all this. Now, for the first 12 years of his career, he was from 40 to 52 years old, he was very much persecuted by his own tribe even, and his own people in Mecca where he grew up, because they didn't like his monotheistic ideas. They liked the polytheistic gods, the idol worshippers, and they didn't like his messages, and he was persecuted. And if you look at the Quran, you need to know this, it's made up of 114 chapters called surahs. Now, the way it's built is that they're not ordered chronologically. They're ordered according to length. It starts out with the lengthiest surah and it ends with the shortest surah. So it's totally not chronological. In order to understand how the Quran is built, you need to download a list from the internet that gives you the chronological order of the surahs. And it's like, basically, there are two periods of time in Muhammad's life. The first 12 years were in Mecca, and these are two-thirds of the chapters, basically. And then you have the last 10 years in Medina, Al-Medina. Al-Medina is the city or the state. It was first called Yathrib. He emigrated there. After 12 years in Mecca, he emigrated there. And the last 10 years of his life, he spent there. And that was a totally different time. Now he was the ruler. He had a community. He had an army. And he started being a warlord. He started being a chief. And he went and he started military campaigns attacking all the other tribes and making Islam into a community, a political state, a city-state. And over those 10 years, he unified all of the Arabian Peninsula, but based on warfare. He attacked everyone until everyone was terrified. After 8 years, he came back to Mecca, and he didn't have to kill anyone. They were all shaking with fear, and he just took over the city. And by the end of those 10 years, all of the Arabian Peninsula was under his rule, and they were all Muslims. Now, if you read the Quran, then about two-thirds of the chapters are from Mecca, and they're very, very peaceful. And they're all about prayer and about believing in God. There's only one God. There's a lot of talk about hell, a lot of descriptions about the punishments the sinners will get in hell. But otherwise, there's no violence. If you hear from people that Islam is a religion of peace and that they're anti-coercion and that there's so many beautiful passages in the Quran, I can assure you it's all coming from those chapters that were from Mecca. But then you have the other third. And the other third of the surahs, the chapters, are from Medina. Medina is the state. Again, it was called another name. It became the state. Why? Because that's when Islam became a political entity. It started governing. They are very different in nature, those chapters. And they have a lot of rules and regulations, and they're very much placing positing Islam as a force to be reckoned with and a force that you need to be careful about. And it ends up almost like a crescendo with Surah number 9, which is a pretty long one. That's why it's a small number. It's early on in the book. Basically, the surahs from both chapters of his life are like two decks of cards that have been shuffled. Because it's organized by length and not by chronological order, then you can have one surah from Mecca, and then one from Medina, and then two from Mecca, and one from Medina. It's all mixed up. But if you put them in order, you see the jump very clearly from Mecca to Medina. And then you see that in Medina, he's becoming a totally different figure, and it's all about striking fear. And he's a fighter, he's a commander, he's a king. Anyone who insults him needs to be killed. And he did engage in radical warfare during this time. That's how he unified the peninsula. And chapter 9 is basically like his last will and testament. It's the one before last chapter, chronologically, in which he says that all the peace treaties are going to be cancelled in a few months' time. And then whoever doesn't accept Islam, you kill him. This is basically what he says. If they don't accept Islam, you kill them. If they accept Islam, that's okay. Islam means to surrender. They can surrender to Islam. Aslam taslam. Surrender. Sorry. Aslam taslam. Surrender, you will have peace. Become a Muslim, that's surrender. You'll have peace. If you're a Jew and a Christian, you can remain a Jew and a Christian as long as you're subjugated to Islamic rule and you pay a certain tax that you need to pay being a non-Muslim. So they had this. They were exempt. Jews and Christians, because he saw them as stages leading up to Islam, they could have the status of being dhimmi. Dhimmi means that they're subservient to Islam, and then you don't have to kill them. But if you don't accept Islam and you're not part of this status, that's humiliated status, they need to pay this tax, then you're going to have to be killed. That's his last will and testament. The very last surah is a very, very short one about being grateful to Allah for giving him Mecca. So it's that's like a little ending. But the last substantial surah is the one before last, and that's his last will and testament. Now what happened was that after Muhammad passed away, then you had the fastest growing empire in the history of humankind. Within a little over 100 years, the Islamic Caliphate was up, and it stretched from the shores of the Atlantic in Spain, it included all of Spain, well into India, north of India. It was one of the biggest empires ever built, and the one to be built over the shortest period of time. So if you remember that Christianity was peaceful for 3 centuries, until it in a way betrayed its own theology by becoming the state religion of Roman Empire, Islam is the very, very opposite of it. Muhammad himself was a warrior, fighter, the opposite of the emasculated, passive, powerless crucified Jesus. He was a fighter. He wanted to strike fear and he wanted to rule, and he was successful. And the legacy that he left was that within 100 years, there was a massive empire all bowing down to this new religion called Islam. In a way, by the way, the Crusades, one of the reasons for the Crusades, right, the jihad, is the war of the Muslims to expand the rule of Islam until ideally it's supposed to extend to the entire world. All the world has to be one Islamic state, according to Islam. The Crusades were a limited phenomena that was, in a way, a defense against the jihad. And it goes totally against Christian theology. So Christianity is radically nonviolent to a fault, that you internalize violence and then it can burst out, and also leaves you vulnerable and exposed to, let's say, Islam. And Islam is the opposite. Islam is unabashedly political and unabashedly violent. It's not a thing to be ashamed of. And that's why they have swords in their flags, and that's why to this day it's a very deeply political religion. Let's give a tiny example. If you compare just to finish this point. So the finish this point is that if Christianity was born out of the spirit of the oral Torah of Judaism, then Islam was born out of the spirit of the written Torah of Judaism. Islam was what Muhammad was impressed by was not the stories and commentaries and complex readings that the sages did, or the spirit, the peaceful spirit of the world of the sages. He didn't care for that. What he enjoyed was the stories of the Bible. And the Quran is full of stories from the Bible. What stories? The stories of the plague, the stories of Sodom and Gomorrah, the stories of the 10 plagues in Egypt. They loved those stories because that's punishment for the sinners, punishment for the idol worshippers. God is a monarch, a powerful monarch. Everyone should bow down to God. They love the stories of the Bible, of the written Bible, the written Torah. That's the God that Muhammad wanted. He wanted the God of the written Torah, not the God of the oral Torah. And he didn't like Christianity, the passive and polite religion that's all about turning the other cheek. No! Forget about turning the other cheek. I'm going to cut off the head of the person who slapped me on the face. I'm not going to. By the way, Islam, early on, beheaded its enemies. It was very common. Muhammad himself oversaw this. There was one Jewish tribe, there were three Jewish tribes in Medina, and two were exiled, and the third one, they killed all the men. They said they were siding with the enemy. They beheaded all the men, and they took all the wives and children as slaves. This was the way it was in Arabian Peninsula. This is the way it was in early Islam and also in late Islam. Because today, most of capital punishment, hanging, flogging, stoning, what is called by, I don't like this term, it's called female circumcision. It's not female circumcision, it's female genital mutilation. It's much worse than circumcision. That's widely held. All these very brutal, very violent acts are widely held in many, many Muslim countries. Not all Muslim countries, not all Muslims are violent. I'm sure that many, if not most of Muslims are very, very peaceful people, and they want to lead a peaceful life. And they have all the chapters, which are the majority of the chapters in the Quran, two-thirds, from Mecca, from the early period of Muhammad, to give them, to inspire them, to lead a good life as, you know, individuals and families and communities, and give charity and be very good people. But the fact of the matter is that the trajectory of Islam throughout Muhammad's life, and which carried on after his life, the trajectory was to move from this state of passivity towards a state of jihad, that it wants to, through military means, take over the entire world and subject it to the rule of Islam and the rule of Allah. And the reason is, again, is that they took the spirit of the written Torah and they rejected the spirit of the oral Torah. They don't have the concept of 70 facets or of rereading verses in a way that softens them or in a way that alleviates the punishment or that makes capital punishment nearly virtually impossible to actualize. No. That's why it's widespread in Muslim countries to have capital punishment, more than anywhere in the world. Well, maybe China, but China, we agreed that communism is the most lethal, the most violent ideology, is also the most atheist one. But in terms of religions, then Islam may not have as bloody a history as Christianity, but its violence is part and parcel of its theology and its outlook on life. Christianity ended up being violent despite of itself. Islam was very violent by virtue of its very explicit theology. What both religions lack is this deep, deep, interesting balance that is in the Torah between the written Torah and the oral Torah. If we only had the written Torah, we may have been not so dissimilar from Islam, because the Torah tells us that we need a lot of capital punishment and we need to wage warfare and all this. But fortunately, we do have the oral Torah. And that's why Judaism doesn't look like Islam at all. It's not as violent. There's no massive wave of Jewish terrorism washing over the world. But on the other hand, we didn't go the Christian route either. We didn't say, oh, the written Torah, the Tanakh, that's obsolete. No, we're canceling that. We're calling it the Old Testament, or we're calling it the obsolete book. No, no, no. We're saying it's still valid, but we need to read it through the lens of the Oral Torah. And then we end up with a very interesting tension in which we don't repress the element of violence, the element of power, the element of warfare. We don't repress it. We know it exists. We're ready for it. And we're also willing to meet force with force if necessary. And we know we need to be strong. We need to protect our borders. We need to fight terrorism. We're not going to open our gates to enemies. We're not going to wash the feet of immigrants from Muslim countries and let them know that they can take over our continent or our land. But neither are we going to be like them. We have this balance. I mean, we're not going to have a society that looks like one of the Islamic countries, a dictatorship, in which if you oppose the regime, you're killed. And if you do a bunch of other things, you're killed. If you're an apostate in Islam, if you're ex-religious, then you need to be sentenced to death, according to Islamic law. If you're homosexual, all these things. So, now, the thing I wanted to say before was that it's beautiful to compare how each religion begins counting its calendar. What is the beginning of the year in Judaism, in Christianity, and Islam? Very telling. In Judaism, Rosh Hashanah, the new year, is the day in which mankind was created. It's the birthday of Adam and Eve. It's the birthday of humanity. We celebrate, it's the beginning of the world, the creation of the world, 6 days prior. And that day is the creation of mankind. So that's the beginning of time. That makes sense, very simple. In Christianity, what is the new year? The new year goes together with Christmas. Christmas is the time that who they claim to be the Mashiach, the Messiah, is born. So this is a religion that's based on a miraculous event of the Son of God being embodied in physical form. And this miraculous event, that's the beginning of Christianity. So it's something that's outside of nature, outside of reality, very much goes along with their desire to be a religion of prayer and contemplation and something that transcends nature altogether. So it's this miraculous event of Jesus being born. That's the beginning of the calendar, beginning of the year. Or very, very adjacent to it. What about Islam? How does the Islamic calendar begin? The Islamic calendar does not begin the counting of the years and the beginning of each year. It doesn't begin with the birth of Muhammad. That's not an important event. It doesn't begin with Muhammad becoming a prophet, receiving his first prophecy, his first awakening. It was an important moment. It was the beginning of the Quran, beginning of the years of his being the prophet in Mecca and so on. That's not how they count their calendar. When did they start counting it? When he moved from Mecca to Medina. It's called the Hijra, the migration. From Mecca to Medina, that's the beginning of the Islamic calendar, although Islam began 12 years before. Why? Because only when Islam becomes a state does it really begin. Mecca is just like a prologue. It's a 12-year-long prologue. But the real beginning is having political power and governing and ruling. So, we said in the beginning we want to compare the varieties of religious violence. Some people say that all religions are prone to violence. Other people say, no, none of the religions are violent. They're equally all about kindness and love and charity, but they can be abused by some people who hate religion or who abuse the texts that each religion has. This is imprecise to the extreme. The reality is that you have two religions that have this aim, the explicit aim, to take over the world, but they're totally different, opposite. One is totally nonviolent in its theology. It's totally, if you read the New Testament, it's absolute zero condoning of violence. But it ended up being very violent. Why? Precisely because it ignored the necessity to use force in certain contexts. And when you repress it, and you don't deal with it, and you don't give it room, then it ends up ruling you. It ends up being the rule instead of the exception to the rule, and you end up with the Crusades and the Inquisition and all this history, but it ended up going back to its roots and being again nonviolent to a fault. And on the other hand, you have Islam that brandished the sword and unabashedly talked about force and political force and violence, and has the most violent theology that we have, without the softening element of an oral Torah to weaken it and make it and have it create a much more peaceful community. Again, many Muslim communities can be very peaceful, but if they go back to their theology, there's so much room there to be radicalized. If a Christian goes back to its original text, to the original text, they become pacifists. If a Muslim goes back to it, to their original texts, they can become radicalized in no time. And in the center, you have the religion that gave birth to both these religions. And that's the most interesting one in this sense, in that it has the written Torah and the oral Torah. And the written Torah is the spirit out of which the Quran, which by the way, Quran is very much like Mikra, same root, comes from the word Mikra, which is Bible. It's coming out of the written Torah. So you have both the Mikra, the written Torah, that says the world is a violent place. And sometimes you need to meet violence with violence. And there is room for political force. There is room to have borders and to keep your borders. And there's room for fighting and you don't have to be ashamed of it. However, we also have the oral Torah, which is all about let's minimize the use of power as much as we can. Let's minimize it to the minimum. Let's not exercise capital punishment unless we absolutely have to. Right? 75 years of the state of Israel, we only executed one person, Adolf Eichmann, Nazi. That's it. No executions. Again, maybe to a fault. Maybe it's too much influenced by Christianity. Maybe we need to have capital punishment for terrorists. So, but the idea is that we're looking for this balance, and it's an interesting balance. It's not just not too much violence and not too little violence, or not to be, it's somewhere in between powerfulness and powerlessness. It's to really hold on to both sides of this complicated truth, that there is an absolute morality that we need to fight for, and it's transcendent and it's divine. But the way we want to bring it into the world is we want it to come into the world in a very soft way, in a very measured way, in a way that we minimize the violence of it as much as we can. So this was a longer than expected review of this essay that I wrote and this thesis that I'm proposing about the varieties of religious experience. And I hope you came out informed more than you were before, and that this gives you some understanding of what's going on in the world today and the two massive religions that are fighting each other, what they represent. And what is our mission, our calling, our purpose is to try and give to the world an ethics of war, an ethics of politics that is truly balanced, that we're not going to allow jihadi terrorism to flourish, but we're not going to resort to those kind of terrorist techniques either. And we want to fight power, and we're going to be very unabashed about it, but we also want to create a world in which is very peaceful and very tolerant, and that allows people to pursue the truth in an environment that allows them to learn, to fall, to make mistakes, to grow, and allows all of us to have this dialogue. The Oral Torah is all about a dialogue between different people with different opinions until common truths emerge, and that's really what we're hoping for. So that's in many ways the mission of the Jewish people, is to represent this balance and to offer it to the world and serve as an example for this. This video was made possible through the kind support of my sponsors over at Patreon. Patreon is a great way to help independent creators like myself produce original content. If you'd like to get more English language videos from me, please consider becoming a supporter via Patreon. You can find the link in the description below. Thank you very much.